Hello and welcome to Focus on Business. I'm your host, Lee Strickland. On today's program, my guest is a returning guest, Nick Dranias, President and Executive Director with the Office of the President of Compact for America Educational Foundation Incorporated, and he's here about the Balanced Budget Amendment for the federal government and the process of getting each state to support it. Nick's here to give us an update and to get us in the know on what the next steps are for North Carolina and where everything stands, and we're excited to have him back here. So before I let Nick start talking about where we stand, let's refresh your memory. The Compact for a Balanced Budget is an interstate agreement that advances, proposes, and ratifies a federal balanced budget amendment in a single state legislative bill, which is activated by a single congressional resolution. In essence, the compact pre-commits 38 states, that's the magic ratification number, to the entire constitutional amendment process in advance so that a specific pre-drafted federal balanced budget amendment is voted up or down within 24 hours at the convention it organizes. The compact's amendment process is set in a motion by a congressional resolution, which can be passed with a simple majorities and no presidential signature. The congressional resolution both calls for the 24-hour convention contemplated by the compact and pre-selects a legislative ratification, avoiding a second trip to Congress. Four states have joined the compact as of April, and Nick's going to give us an update on how many states have ratified it to this point. Nick, thanks for being back on the show today.
Hey, Lee, it's great to be on. One of the really important things that are going on in the world holds a huge lesson for us in America. I'm sure you're aware of the Greek crisis, and that's my people, at least half of my family. And then we've got the looming Puerto Rican crisis, and then on top of that, we were watching China's stock markets implode from excessive money printing. Sounds familiar, doesn't it? Well, the root cause of all these problems is the abuse of national debt. It's in all of these countries, and it's something that's played out time and time again, going back to the Romans, even if you count their experiments with currency inflation is similar to this. So, you know, the bottom line is history is filled with repetition that governments abuse the capacity to borrow. They abuse it. They do not catch themselves before the crash. The crash happens, and then we start the process all over again. The goal of a federal balanced budget amendment is to nip that process in the bud, to make sure that the federal government lives within its means, that it has a limit on its borrowing capacity, so there isn't room to create these bubbles that inevitably burst, and to encourage levels of dependency by the people and unsustainable spending.
Well, I mean, Greece is a perfect example of that right now, because they have just created a system that had people retiring early, getting benefits for decades and decades after working to 45 or 50, and it was just not sustainable with the amount of population they had. And every day their debt got greater, but nobody wanted to address the issues to do the cleanup. And that's sort of the foreshadowing of where we're sitting here in the United States, isn't it?
It absolutely is, and the foreshadowing is more than just a shadow. We're exactly where Greece was in 2007 in terms of the amount of our national debt relative to everything we produce in a year, called the gross domestic product. We are over 100% of our gross domestic product in national debt. That's where Greece was in 2007. We've been hanging at over 100% of gross domestic product in the national debt since 2007. And so the bottom line is that we have not learned from the lessons that are beating us over the head around the world. And the reason for this is the federal government does have unlimited borrowing capacity. And it's like giving an unlimited credit card to your, you know, least responsible cousin and hoping that if you just talk to him the nice way, maybe he'll stop spending. But that just doesn't work, because what politicians do with their unlimited credit card is they buy votes to get elected, they send the bill to future generations that don't yet vote, and they're happily out of office with a sweet pension of their own when everything comes crashing down. And that is a process that happens over and over and over again unless we first limit how much they can borrow. And that's what a balanced budget amendment is all about at its root.
So how are things progressing around the country? In April, when you were on with us, there were 4 states that had ratified this. Are there more states that have joined?
Well, we got through 5 chambers in 5 states. Unfortunately, a series of strange events, things like a sexting scandal in Missouri, shut down the House, so we didn't get through the House in Missouri, even though we got through the Senate overwhelmingly. Alabama, the Republican supermajority there wasn't willing to face down a threatened filibuster from the Democrats, so our bill did not get carried to the floor, even though it was poised to get to the floor of the House side, even though we passed the Senate overwhelmingly. We're still pushing in Alabama to try to get it incorporated into their special session. The governor may take that up, because in the end, their state budget is as dependent on good federal fiscal policy as any federal fiscal policy is dependent on good federal fiscal policy, because so many states are reliant on federal funding, and if the federal government borrows itself into oblivion, that means big chunks of state budgets will not be sustainable. So it's in everyone's interest, state and federal, to get the federal balanced budget amendment in place. In addition to that, we've got 3 bills still moving forward. We're poised to get to the Senate floor in Michigan. Ohio just filed with 7 co-sponsors about a week ago, and we're hopeful that's going to pick up steam with as many as 20 or more sponsors. North Carolina is still alive. It's HB 366, and our lead sponsor, Representative Millis, has been working it hard. The Compact for Balanced Budget Commissioners, the chairperson, Paulette Rakestra, Georgia legislator as well, she's swung by to educate folks. You know, we get nothing but good words out of folks in the legislature, and it just seems like things have slowed down for the summer, so we can use as much help as your audience can offer to pump that up a notch. Bottom line is this, we've targeted 12 states, we got it done in 2, we got through the first chamber in 5, we got 3 states still pending, and 2 states that just didn't get off the ground. We think that this is a great product that in the end is going to end up with 5 to 7 states in the compact by the end of the year. And then on top of that, we've got the congressional resolution that's moving forward steadily. We've got 20 sponsors on the House side now. We've picked up our first sponsor that will be introducing the Senate side version of the congressional resolution. That's Georgia Senator Perdue. We're hopeful that Senator Cornyn will join in that, because he's been educated about the effort and really supports it. And then, of course, there's a lot of other characters running for president that we wouldn't throw out of bed for eating cookies if they wanted to support it too.
So what efforts have been most effective in the states where you've seen this make it through the system? Has it been email campaigns? Has it been calling? Is it just purely the education? What can we do in North Carolina to get this moving from your experience?
Well, folks need to beat on their legislators the sense of urgency that the crisis in Greece, Puerto Rico, and China should be telling them. The biggest obstacle that we have faced in our path has not been fear of a convention organized by a strict binding agreement like we're advancing. It's been a lack of urgency, a lack of, you know, sense on the part of many legislators that there's anything to be really worried about the federal debt. I mean, that's, you know, North Dakota and Mississippi jumped on board early this session because their leadership down to the last man and woman in the legislature saw the danger of the federal debt. They were uniquely animated about fixing the problem, and it just caught fire because they saw this huge looming problem. Other states that moved fairly rapidly through their first chamber saw it the same way, only to get tripped up by weird, crazy things that happened in the second chamber. But by and large, we've found that about 3 to 5 of the states that we've targeted this session, including North Carolina, there just does not seem to be an awareness of the urgency of the problem that we're attacking and the shortness of time that we have to fix that problem. And so the number one thing that I think that the public can do is to talk to their legislator and send them links to the latest news in Greece, where the banks have not, you know, given out any more than the equivalent of about $60 a day to anyone asking, if you can even get that out.
Well, and the banks were officially closed yesterday.
Exactly, and where people are starting to panic because they can't, you know, get the imports and the goods that they need. And even though Greece is a tiny economy that doesn't produce a whole lot, I mean, the reality is that Greece is going to have a huge ripple effect. It's going to throw into jeopardy all sorts of sovereign debt all throughout Europe, and then that's going to rebound and hit us eventually. And that means interest rates are going to go up on the federal debt. Either that or we're just going to print tons of money and cause inflation to happen. But either way, there's going to be huge consequences to pay in the near future for this unsustainable borrowing in the federal government. And even though we're not watching the world fall around us like Greece is or like Puerto Rico is, the fact is it's inevitable, and we're fortunate that we're not yet at that point because we still have time to fix the problem. And so this is the challenge, is folks need to say, look, you are getting a glimpse of the future. It's almost like you're Doctor Who, you know, stepping off the TARDIS, if that's not too weird a popular reference. And you can see what our future inevitably will be. Look at Greece, look at Puerto Rico, look at the trail of second and third world countries that have overspent and overborrowed over the years. That's our future. It's inevitable. It always happens. That's the end of the road. Are we going to stop us from following that road, that path, while we still have time? We believe at Compact for America, our economists believe that we have a good 5 years to change the path that our nation is on before a default or massive hyperinflation to get out from under the debt becomes inevitable. And that means that we've got to get this job done with 38 states by April 2021, or else we just, you know, we're on a path that there is no remedy for other than the inevitable system reset. And so this is the urgency people need to say is, look, tell their legislator, we don't want to be where Greece is. We don't want to be where Puerto Rico is. We don't want to be where Argentina was. We don't want to be where Mexico was several times. You know, we want to be where America should be, a shining city on a hill that is an example and that maintains the infrastructure of freedom, both legally and culturally, for the foreseeable future. Because we can see right now, you know, folks who thought that maybe we could hand off, you know, our role is a beacon of civilization to places like China, they can look and see what's happening in their stock market, and they're just crashing like a stone right now. They have been for a week and a half or more now, and we can see that you know, around the world, there is no place that can replace America as the leader for the civilized world, as the beacon of hope and freedom. There just isn't. If this system fails, there's nothing good that can replace it, not that we see anywhere on the horizon. And that's very dangerous for civilization in general. It's reminiscent of what happened after Rome fell. You know, there's no guarantee that progress will continue indefinitely when you don't have a shining example of the benefits of civilization and freedom in front of everybody's eyes. People need to see that concretely. America needs to be that, because there isn't anyone else stepping up to the plate.
Well, and pointing back to, first let's talk about Rome. We're always told, if we don't learn from our history, we're doomed to repeat it. We don't see in the history of man and all the civilizations anything that survives when they don't take charge, when they don't change what they're doing, when they don't wake up and realize that they're destroying the system that created the greatness and enabled the world to thrive, whether that's the United States or that's Greece or Rome in previous, you know, centuries or millennia even. So we're sitting here, we see on the news, you know, I've been watching this, and when people talk about Puerto Rico, they say, oh, you know, Puerto Rico is really not going to default. The United States, because it's part of the United States, will, you know, pay off their debt and make their payments. But the reality is we're borrowing money from China and other countries at an interest rate to pay off a debt for Puerto Rico, for other, wherever we're, you know, we're going to reach out and we're going to do this. So we're setting up a system of borrowing money to pay off money that was borrowed, that defaulted, that requires us to print money, that it's a house of cards.
It absolutely is a house of cards. And so, you know, folks, if they want to educate their legislator, particularly in the state of North Carolina, where we have a very strong sponsor, we've got a lot of positive responses. We just, the fear and the response, the sense of responsibility that should accompany the news of the past few days about Greece is it's not yet being felt. So folks need to send, you know, a note to their legislator to you know, educate them about the dangers of proceeding along this path. It should be, you know, readily apparent right now that you can't just keep borrowing more than we produce in a given year, that you just can't keep spending in deficits in the hundreds of billions and even trillions of dollars and expect it to continue forever. We can't expect China to rescue us with their economic situation looking like it's going to blow up as a bubble, as ours did a few years ago. You know, the reality is we got to get our house back in order. We have to live within our means. We have to prioritize. We have to have a reason to prioritize. That means we can't allow our federal politicians an unlimited credit card, just like we don't allow our state politicians in 49 states an unlimited credit card. Now, we do it, you know, better in some places and worse than others at the state level, but the fact of the matter is in 50 states, there maybe are only two or three that have a fiscal situation anywhere near as bad as a federal government, and that's pretty good odds. I mean, that tells you that when you amend a constitution, even though, as we've seen for the last Supreme Court session, there's no guarantees that that constitution will be enforced or interpreted correctly, but the reality is that as long as the language is in the constitution, and until it's not interpreted correctly, it sets a moral high ground. It changes the political debate. It gives people an advantage who side with the constitution that they would not otherwise have. And so we see that play out in the states over and over again, where most states, by and large, have a more sustainable fiscal policy than the federal government, one that isn't going to destroy any, you know, the country or the system of that state. And the key to all of this is just to limit the borrowing capacity of elected officials. Don't give them the ability to buy votes without limit and without cost. You take that away from them, you know, you're not going to get nirvana necessarily, but you will stop an insane pattern of behavior that crashes systems that we've seen in history over and over again.
And when we're looking at the dynamics of this, we're coming down to some extent, a states' rights and federal rights type of thing. The states need to reclaim the right to hold the federal government accountable, whether that's, you know, we have three branches of government, and I think people think it's the two houses of Congress and the president, but it's the legislative branch, which is both houses of Congress, the executive branch, the president, and the judicial branch. And right now, we have everybody out of balance with nobody accountable to the voters or to the states for how they're spending money and how they're legislating. Even if, I mean, illegal immigration, our debt, you know, our foreign policy, all of this is coming into this massive trifecta of things that are going to have an effect on our economy and how our citizens are able to sustain their lives.
We have a vicious circle of irresponsibility and a failure to prioritize and to recognize our priorities at, you know, every level of the federal government, and even in many states, but nowhere near as badly. And you know, what is the root cause of that irresponsibility? Well, there's a lot of cultural causes. There's a lot of vicious circles where one form of irresponsibility leads to another. But what is the thing that covers over the consequences of irresponsible behavior like we see at the federal government? What makes it possible to get away with not prioritizing, with, you know, just absorbing whoever crosses the border, no matter what they offer our country? What is enabling us to just sort of paper over that? Well, the reality is it's unlimited borrowing capacity. As long as we can keep spending money without limit, without immediate cost, then we can do all sorts of stupid and crazy things because the consequences are never felt. Now, if we feel the consequences, does that mean we're not going to do stupid and crazy things? No, look at Greece. I mean, they're getting cut off from their free money, and most of the people in Greece still want to somehow, you know, keep the gravy train going, and
well,
they just voted to do that.
I mean, this is not the first time, though, they've gone through this, because, you know, it was just a few years ago, they had that little morning shaking where they could only take out a little bit of money, and they almost defaulted before, and they didn't learn from that lesson. Again,
right,
because somebody
right.
printed the money and paid their bills for them.
Right. But the point I'm making is not that, you know, cutting off the free money or limiting the free money guarantees results. What I am saying, though, is if you don't do that, you're not going to get anything better. It's guaranteed you're going to continue the irresponsibility, and even worse, you're going to replace responsibility with irresponsibility as the cultural norm, where basically people are going to feel like chumps if they live within their means, if they don't take the free stuff. And that's the problem that Greece is now trapped in, is that most of their population is corrupted. They're corrupted by irresponsibility. They feel, and the corruption is not just the easy money, it's the feeling like if they don't take their piece of the action, somebody else will. So they're being foolish. That morality, that responsibility, that thrift, that self-restraint, all of these things are for chumps. That's the problem. When the culture shifts in that direction, it's very hard to see how anything other than a total system crash can clear that behavior out. And that's probably what's going to happen in Greece.
Well, and again, commentators are on TV talking about this, and the investment guys, they're just saying, you know, this long-term, this doesn't really affect our markets. Long-term, it's not going to have a significant impact. And so how do we kind of counter that information that, you know, the United States is you know, bulletproof, that we're always going to exist when we've only existed, you know, less than 300 years at this point?
Well, I think the starting point is that. I mean, first of all, widen your perspective and think of the great empires of the world that have collapsed in the blink of an eye at certain tipping points. I mean, in the 19th century, the British Empire was ascendant in control of everything. By the 1950s, it was gone. 50 years. And really, that most of that collapse happened in you know, between World War I and after World War II. Look at the Roman Empire. I mean, they were the shining beacon and showed no sign of collapse until they got within 100 to 200 years of their eventual demise. Everywhere you look at the Soviet Union. In the 1980s, people were still thinking they were going to bury us, and they collapsed within a decade. So you can look around the world, and you can see time and time again supposedly, you know, invincible empires collapsing. And, you know, the difference between all of those situations and ours is that, you know, we've got everything plainly in front of our eyes. I mean, you know, it wasn't clear that, you know, to the people of those times that they were on the verge of collapse. But we've got all of the writing on the wall. I mean, we can see that we're borrowing more than we produce in a year. We can see that we're promising entitlement programs that exceed the entire value of everything we have in the country. I mean, the latest estimate puts it at $210 trillion in unfunded entitlement program promises. The present value, that's what Lawrence Kotlikov from Boston University said. So we know right now, anybody who can read, who can surf the Internet, can see that we are on a sinking ship. And so that's the difference between all these other, you know, situations and ours, is that we've got people saying everything's fine. Well, we have the facts to know that they're not fine, and we also have the time to fix the problem. So we can either allow ourselves to be lulled into disbelief of the facts by people who just want to say everything's fine in disregard of the facts, or we can take action and do what we know has got to be done. We have to live within our means. Everything around us tells us that. Everything we do in our individual lives tells us that. It's not any different just because you scale up to a country size.
Well, and I mean, the fairy tale or the story that kind of comes to mind is the emperor's new clothes. We're actually in a situation of the, you know, an economic emperor, and no one wants to point out that he's naked, that there are no clothes. And we have...
Absolutely.
Go ahead.
And let me emphasize, if you really want to break it down, let's say, you know, all of these observations are just too abstract for people to see the threat. Let's just break it down in terms of numbers. Right now, our interest at near zero, right, the lowest we've ever seen Treasury interest rates in history, our interest payment is still 7% of our entire federal budget. Now, 7% of our entire federal budget means we're spending more on interest, even with that little sliver. We're still spending more on interest than we're spending on all the judiciary functions of the federal government, all of the environmental protection functions, which maybe shouldn't exist, but nevertheless, we're spending more on that. All of the non-Medicare, Medicaid expenditures on health care, all of our expenditures on education and transportation. So all of our interest, even at this tiny, tiny, tiny level, is displacing or is exceeding the spending on all of these other programs that many people hold dear or at least are concerned about. Now, what happens to our budget if our interest rates just went back to normal, just doubled, you know? Then suddenly that 7% becomes 14%. Where does the 7% addition get cut from? I mean, the reality is that two-thirds of our budget is split between military, Medicaid, and Medicare and Social Security. And so that extra 7% is going to come button up against some very powerful interest groups that are going to preserve those things. Most of that 7% are going to cut out what's left of the federal government's activities. And so basically, if we just go back to normal interest rates, at best, we're going to cut everything else out of the budget, other than, you know, military, Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, because of the political pushback. Now, what happens, you know, so then basically the federal government becomes this giant conduit for, you know, either paying the military or paying our Social Security and health care benefits. So then what happens if we go up to 1970s levels? If
that's
we
what I was just thinking, quadruple? Right.
Yes.
18% interest and higher.
Right. Now you're talking about an interest share of the budget that's a quarter, a third, maybe a 40% of the entire federal budget. Well, now you're talking huge bloodletting. You're talking cutting the military down way past the bone. You're talking about, you know, throwing people off of Social Security. You're talking about getting people, you know, tossing people off of Medicaid and Medicare. I mean, you're talking about pandemonium in a society where nearly 50% of America is dependent on those things. And so, look, it doesn't take much if you just play with the numbers to see where this irresponsibility takes us and where it could take us in the next 5 to 10 years. And so we've got a choice. Do we want to risk all of that, which is very plausible? It doesn't do anything other than what history has already done in the past, and really seriously risk, you know, our country becoming another Somalia, or do we try to write the correction of the course and to limit the borrowing we're borrowing and to just slowly taper down our spending to coincide with limiting our borrowing and get on a sustainable path? It may not be a path of perfection. It may not be one where, you know, conservatives feel perfectly copacetic, but it will at least not collapse our system and produce a situation with, you know, most of Americans in dependency and not having the means to support themselves and the pandemonium that would have to result from that.
Well, and there can be one unrelated, let's call it an unrelated event, if we had, heaven forbid, another 9/11. If we had a series of small terrorist attacks around the country that hit different infrastructure, if our power grid's been out, that could be that little spark that creates this domino effect that makes everything go down.
Absolutely. And see, this is the other thing. We're projecting out a static world in which the only bad thing that happens is our doubling or quadrupling of our interest rates, right?
Right.
I mean, if that's all the world can dish out at us, we're doing pretty good. You know, the reality is that we've got recessions that will hit us. We've got terrorism that will hit us. We'll have other unforeseen things hit us. Who knows? Maybe earthquakes. Maybe a meteor strike. Maybe the supervolcano in Yellowstone. Whatever. I mean, the point is, we have so many, you know, huge contingencies that can really cause economic harm that we ought to control the things we can control, right? I mean, we should make sure that we're not drilling holes in our lifeboat
right.
as we're trying to roll along. I mean, it's that simple.
Well, and when we look around, we have Detroit, we have, you know, other cities that are on the brink of bankruptcy. We have malfeasance that throws some organizations into those kind of situations. And then we just have this willful blindness that no one wants to talk about making the hard decisions. If we're talking about a household, and the United States essentially is a household, just on a much larger scale, at some point your creditors have to have their money. And when they call that and you don't have it, and there's, let's say we print more money, and one of the points that I think people forget is it's really not the United States government printing money, it's the Federal Reserve, which is a private entity. And so, you know, we're not even really setting our own fiscal policies. The monetary policy is driving that, and the Federal Reserve, a private group, is driving that policy. And we see them spreading that type of system, too, around the world. And so that causes concern, too, because what is their interest in making sure we're not having to print money? What is their interest in making sure my household is living within its means and has a rainy day fund in case of a Hurricane Katrina, a 9/11, you know, some other natural disaster or a man-made disaster? There really is an incentive in that because, as far as I can tell, they win regardless.
Well, that's a scary thought, and you know, in the end, this is why people need to educate their legislator. They need to elevate this issue, because I can tell you right now that the folks down in the legislature, you know, except for our sponsor and a handful of co-sponsors and a few other folks, nobody feels that sense of urgency like they should. And in the end, you know, you and I, folks like us, your audience, we're going to get hurt the worst of it if the political class don't take the right action now to prevent the problems from happening.
Well, as the last being born in the last year of the baby boomers, I have always assumed Social Security will not be there for me. You know, when the retirement ages were set, people were living into their 60s. Now we have people living into their 90s and 100s. My grandparents paid into Social Security for just a couple of years. My grandfather retired a couple years after I was born in the mid-60s. He drew it till he was 87, so almost 30 years. Same thing with my grandmother. She never paid into it, but she drew it till she was 92. So they essentially drew out everything I paid in, and God bless them. That's fine. But I know that's the system that we're dealing with now, and it's funded partially, incompletely, with borrowed funds. And when people stop being able to retire at 65 because there's no funds there, or they retire and they find out that buying the value of a dollar that they earned and they put into that account and they counted on is 10 cents, it really is going to hurt. I was talking with one of my colleagues here locally, and the last time the stock market went down, they lost 3/4 of their retirement funds. And so they're in their 80s and they're still working. And that's not what we want as a country that has been productive, that we've had workers, and we're out there. And if we don't take a step now and get the North Carolina legislature and the others around the country moving, we're going to be Greece.
I agree. And so if there's one thing folks can do, it is educate their legislator, write op-eds for the paper, use Facebook, send links about the situation in Greece, and there's plenty of materials on our Compact for America Facebook page. Just go facebook.com/Compact for America. You can get plenty of information from our team of experts on the comparisons between what the world is seeing in Greece and our situation. Send those links around. Educate people. Get people aware that, you know, there is something to be gravely concerned about if we continue along this path as business as usual, and that at the same time we have time to fix it. And not only, you know, let's talk about this a little bit more positively, because you know we're not Greece. You know, Greece chopped down all of their pine trees, you know, 3,000 years ago or 2,000 years ago to build their navies, right? I mean, there's not a whole lot left in Greece that is wealth producing aside from their populace, and their populace right now seems to be more bent on consuming than producing. So, but we're different in that regard in America. I mean, we've got natural resources coming out of our ears. We still have a tradition of self-reliance. We still have a tradition of freedom of enterprise, of entrepreneurship, of risk-taking. You know, one of the coolest things that's happening with the Internet is the fact that so many people are coming up with different apps and products that can bring people together and can use resources in new and efficient ways, like, you know, air bed and breakfast, where you can, you know, lease out your home or a room, or you can even lease out your car in a version of that, or you can do Uber. I mean, there's a million different ideas that are percolating right now in America, where if we just don't have a system crash, all of the seeds that we need for prosperity are going to be able to grow. And it doesn't. So what we need really is not to, you know, do such an irresponsible job of our federal budget that all of these things that are developing and growing in positive ways just get wiped off the board. And so, but there's reason to think that we can not only do, you know, reform this process, save the country, balance the budget, but even prosper beyond that with our traditions of freedom and free enterprise. Give you another example of positive things. It's not exactly dealing with the budget, but you know, energy technologies are developing rapidly to the point where, you know, there are already existing forms of nuclear energy using, say, thorium that are completely safe. They're meltdown free. That could power, you know, 20,000 homes for 10 years for like $10 million, which is just a tiny fraction of what anything costs. And there's even if you look at green technology, I mean, there's a time when that was a complete boondoggle, and in many cases it still is. But, you know, the writing's on the wall with things like Tesla's, you know, new battery and the cost of even solar panels dropping to the ground. And so, you know, there's energy is becoming potentially super cheap. And on top of that, then you've got your traditional, you know, fuels, things like natural gas becoming incredibly abundant and cheap through new technologies and oils and everything. I mean, so, you know, the great news is this, the foundation of an economy, energy sources, energy development, the technologies involved in that is still expanding exponentially. It's still, you know, percolating incredibly. If we could just create a structure of society that isn't completely irresponsible and headlong heading for a crash, we have the ingredients in our economy to really, you know, just grow massively, create all kinds of jobs and all kinds of new prosperity. But we can't do that as we're plowing into an iceberg.
Well, and it's, to that point, we do have all this wonderful thing that is out there. And just think what we could do with that 7% of our economy that we're spending on interest if we had a balanced budget, if we didn't have that payment. That's millions and millions, even trillions of dollars that could be going back into the economy to fund innovation, to support these technologies.
Even worse than that. It's even worse than that. I mean, that the dollar we're spending on interest is like burning money, but it's worse than that. I mean, think of it this way. Imagine you had a halfway decent entrepreneur with a dollar to spend versus a bureaucrat with a dollar to spend. And there's only so much stuff out there that you can spend on, right? You know, there isn't an infinite amount of stuff.
Right.
Every time that bureaucrat spends his dollar, he's taking out of the hands of someone in the private sector who wants to spend a dollar that thing that he's spending on it, right? Whether it's
right.
a car for the government fleet or anything else. And as soon as the government spends that dollar, that borrowed dollar, taking a resource out of the hands of the private sector, study after study shows that the economic benefit of that is actually the same as burning it. You know, it's not like planting a seed, you know, or an investment, as we hear. It's actually like taking that car and blowing it up, right? As opposed to taking that car or that truck and giving it to, you know, a guy who just bought a Domino's franchise, where they're going to create value with that and grow a business. And so the thing that folks have to understand is it's not just that we're wasting money on interest. It's that every time the government spends money, any kind of money, tax dollars, but especially borrowed dollars, it's taking resources away from the far more productive private sector. It is depriving the private sector of the ability to do economic growth, to produce jobs. I mean, studies show that the only thing that government produces net value from its so-called investments is in building out highway infrastructure, right? And that's the one thing we don't see government doing.
Right. Yeah, they want more money to do that, yeah. They want more money to do that, even though we pay the taxes that are supposed to be doing our roads and our bridges.
Right, I mean, but they don't have, you know, they're happy to beat that drum and say that's why we need to raise taxes. But somehow, the one thing where studies show that government produces a little bit more net value than they consume, we just don't do. Instead, we build, you know, bridges to nowhere. And not even particularly good bridges. Things like, you know, rail, light rail, and frog farm subsidies, and ridiculous things that really are just funds transfers to people who are more politically connected than we are. And so, you know, the bottom line is this: if we can curtail government borrowing, we're freeing up resources in the economy for entrepreneur to use that will produce far more jobs and produce far more economic growth than if you left it in the hands of a government bureaucrat. And also by taking the government out of the borrowing markets, you are forcing government to be, you know, thinking a little bit more thoughtfully on what they spend. You know, right now, when an agency spends its money, it thinks that it has to spend every single dollar in its budget or else it's going to get cut. And the only way it can preserve its budget is to make sure every last dollar is spent. Now, that's a culture that is enabled only with a limitless credit card backing it. If instead, you know, agencies realize that, you know, they may not get the budget that they've got next year because we're not going to have the money to spend, then they might actually start creating their own little rainy day fund. They might actually start saving some of their money, not spending every last dime, making sure that when the money may not be there, they can continue their operations. So an entirely different mindset would develop in government over time that doesn't involve spending every last dollar so that they can preserve their budget if we just had a limit on the government's credit card.
Well, and we see the government trying to legislate increases in minimum wage and those kind of things, but the real way to grow wages and real wealth and real, you know, benefit is if in the consumer market, in the private sector, those dollars are available, that Domino's can change their sign, they can rebrand their business, they can, you know, add franchises, they can sell more pizzas, they can hire more people, they can pay better wages, they can do health care. When those dollars come back to the people who use them most productively, then the size of the pie grows and everybody can get a larger slice.
I agree, and that's the key. So how do we get there? The question is, how do we get there? Some folks say just vote the right people into Washington.
That hasn't worked.
You know what? We've been focused on voting the right people to Washington from time immemorial, and it doesn't happen. Why? Because the right people, generally speaking, are not drawn into politics. Right? I mean, the right people are drawn elsewhere. And those that are the right people that get drawn into politics, most of them get corrupted over time. So, you know, the reality is this. We have to accept what the founder said, which is that if we had a nation of angels, we wouldn't need government. Government is, and always will be, consisting of non-angels, and it will be for non-angels as well. And so how do we, assuming that we've got a government of less than, you know, perfect righteous people running it, and also a population of less than perfect righteous people to govern, how do we make sure the system works best? Well, one of the ways it's abundantly necessary is you don't hand anybody an unlimited credit card, right? You don't say, here, knock yourself out, get yourself elected by promising whatever you can under the sun. If you don't do that, if you don't take away that unlimited credit card, then you're basically giving a teenage kid a liquor and car keys and saying, knock yourself out. And that's what we're getting from this system. We're getting a system that is driving into a brick wall of reality. The only reason why it's not seen sooner than it is that the power to tax hides the costs of this behavior, so that in the end, markets will keep lending the government money because they'll think the government will just get it from taxes. It's only after it becomes way, way excessive that everybody wakes up and says, holy cow, there isn't all the taxes in the world to pay for this. And then the creditors stop lending, they start calling in what they're owed, and the music stops. The whole system shuts down. And we see that in Greece right now. And it's not a theory, it's a proven fact. And we've got time in our country, if and only if we start making the reforms we need for the political class to at least behave not crazily, not insanely, not irresponsibly. It doesn't guarantee responsible behavior. It doesn't guarantee good policy. But we have to take away the kindling that creates this fire of insane fiscal policy, and that's this unlimited borrowing capacity that the federal government has.
So our first step is to get this balanced budget amendment going. And so we can go to your Facebook page it's facebook.com/Compact for America to get information, to educate ourselves, to share on our websites, our social media, to talk to our legislators, to call our senators and our congressmen, I'm assuming, too.
Absolutely. And then also we've got a couple of websites, compactforamerica.org, where you can get all the white papers that you want to read to your heart's content. Then also compactforamerica-action.org, where you can see where legislative efforts are pending in your state and elsewhere. And the key thing here is, again, let's beat into the collective drum, the public minds, not just policymakers, but everyone that we can find, that Greece is us in 5 years. You know, Puerto Rico is us right now, and it will be the rest of the country in 5 years if we don't change the course that we're on. And at the same time, you know, let's not be all doom and gloom. Let's point out that, look, all we have to do is fix this crazy problem of, you know, politicians promising more than we can possibly ever fulfill, and we've got all the other ingredients needed for an American revolution in a good sense, in an economic sense, and in a prosperity sense. Energy's cheap. When energy's cheap, economic growth is easy. So if we can just get the stupid public policies out of the way, if we can just get those who want to drive us into a wall to stop driving us into a wall. We've got all the ingredients we need for success and for prosperity in this country.
So after the balanced budget amendment, we talked previously about other things that we could go after. Can you kind of refresh our listeners' minds to what other type of, you know, initiatives we can have next? Because this is a system and a process that we can use to get our government back under our control and not under the politicians' control.
Absolutely. Well, there's a lot of other ideas. Look, what really animates me and our organization is restoring what some people call the vertical separation of powers. Everybody's aware of checks and balances and the division of the federal government into judiciary, legislative, and executive branches. But another key component of our compound republic was to divide power between the states and the federal government, to give the states the bulk of governing authority and to target the federal government to a tiny subset of governing authority focused on, you know, foreign relations and interstate activities. That obviously has been inverted over time. The dominant governing authority in every respect right now is the federal government. States are more like an administrative subdivision, sort of like a special district or a water district or a county. I mean, it's just how it's developed over time, and that's dangerous, because what that means is that power is consolidated in a convenient location where it can be abused. So one of our animating purposes at Compact for America is to divide that power again between, you know, the mechanisms of more local government and the more distant, more international or national government. And we believe that the only area where you see state power unmolested by bad Supreme Court decisions is the amendment power. You know, the reality is yes, it's untested, but because it's been untested, because it hasn't been used successfully, there's almost no case law that has perverted the process. So the original understanding of state control over the amendment process, over the convention process of proposing amendments, which is very easy to prove, and you know, if you ever wanted to walk through the proof on that, we could. But the fact is this: state control over that process, as envisioned by the federal, by the founders, has not been perverted by the court system yet. And so if you're looking for a place to revitalize state authority, to revitalize a check and balance from the states, to revitalize a vertical division of power between the federal governments and the states, the most natural place to do this is to organize the states to use their amendment power, and to do it not with some willy-nilly, you know, crazy, you know, wide agenda that really nobody's ever going to accomplish, but to do it in a targeted fashion, you know, with specific policy ideas that command supermajority support, that can marshal support over time and across the country. Things like a balanced budget amendment, starting this, is why we're focused on a balanced budget amendment. Pound for pound, it gives us the most political support and the most policy impact. But there's many other ideas out there that could unify people similarly and have the very much intended side effect of restoring state power and a check and balance on Washington. Things like term limits, things like banning bailouts, things like getting rid of log rolling and earmarking. I mean, there's a lot of concepts out there that command supermajority support, cross-partisan support, cross-ideological support that you could fold into a future compact idea and target a policy effort to getting it done.
Okay, I have like 7 minutes left. Can you give us a short kind of like primer on this process of how does this work? How do we enact this system and this process that enables us to regain our vertical separations between our state and our federal government?
Step one, go to compactforamerica.org and read everything you can find. Step two, go to our Facebook page /Compact for America and read everything you can find. Now, that being said, here's all we need to do. We need to get 38 states to pass one bill called the Compact for a Balanced Budget. That one bill includes everything involved in amending the Constitution from soup to nuts. It includes the amendment itself down to the rules for the convention, to all the logistics, and even a commitment to ratifying the amendment if it's approved by the convention. So you get 38 states on board with that. The next thing you need to do is get Congress to pass with simple majorities, not supermajorities, just 51%, 50 plus 1 of each house, the concurrent resolution HCR 26, which is currently pending in Congress right now. That resolution which could be passed in October at the same time as the statutory debt limit debate, that it would allow a lot of folks who are going to vote for more debt to win the war even if they lose the battle. If you pass that, then you hand off the fight for federal fiscal responsibility to the states, and it becomes entirely a question of can we get 38 states to agree to this compact, this formal agreement to advance a federal balanced budget amendment. And we have every reason to believe that we can succeed. There are already uniform laws or compacts that have 38 or more states. About 30 of them exist. One of them was achieved at that level of 38-plus states in just 2 years. So unlike all these other approaches to amending the Constitution that you hear about from the states, things like Convention of States or the older Reagan-era stuff, the use of a compact, a formal agreement, to marshal supermajorities of states behind a good public policy, it's been done dozens of times before. There's no good reason with the lessons of Greece and Puerto Rico just abundant before us that we can't achieve this for us in the Compact for a Balanced Budget as well. And so that's what we need to do. If anyone needs to understand how the states have the power to organize an agreement to amend the Constitution, all they need is two principles. One, the 10th Amendment. The 10th Amendment says the states have the power to do everything that they haven't delegated away or that they're not prohibited from doing. The fact that the Constitution in no way prohibits the states from organizing this way means the 10th Amendment reserves their power to do so. The second thing you need to do is read Article 5 itself. Article 5 is the part of the Constitution that defines the amendment power. Notice that it says that a convention for proposing amendments is called, quote, on application of two-thirds of the state legislatures. The application defines the amendment convention. It's the application that triggers the call. The application is just a petition. It's just, for example, the compact. It's just the thing that the states spell out what they want in. And so the idea of state control of a convention for proposing amendments is as plain as the grammatical structure of Article 5 itself. Whatever the states ask for in their application, the convention must provide because it's the application that triggers the convention. So there's my nutshell overview, and again, if anyone wants to learn more, I encourage them to go to compactforamerica.org or compactforamerica-action.org and get on top of this issue. We need all the support we can get, not just in North Carolina, but around the country.
And if they're going to go on Twitter, I want to give them the handle that they need to use. It's at @CFAEducation_C3, so that's at @CharlieFoxtrotAlpha_Education_Charlie3. Also use #HelpMakeHistory, and just make sure we get the North Carolina legislature in there. We want to use @NCLEG, that's @NCLEG, to get them aware and monitoring and so that they can see all of our tweets about this. And again, go on Facebook, like the Compact for America page, and get involved because it's time for us to take back our government and put the power back in our hands. And the best way to do that is to use our constitutional rights. Nick, where are you going to be speaking? Where can they see? Are there any events coming up if someone wants to get involved more directly?
Absolutely. Go to freedomfest.com. We're going to have a debate on Article 5 on Friday, July 10th at 1:30 p.m. at Planet Hollywood in Las Vegas. And then we're also doing a workshop on Saturday at 4 p.m., again, Planet Hollywood, Las Vegas. The workshop is going to be pretty interesting. It's going to be a full hour of detailed training for folks who want to help with the compact initiative. The debate is going to be fascinating, too. We're going to have one perspective that says, I don't care what kind of convention, we should organize a convention that does anything and everything because we got nothing to lose. That's a little bit more radical than my position. We're going to have another gentleman who's going to express the point of view of being skeptical of amending the Constitution. And then we're going to have I'll be presenting our point of view on this, and that is they have a targeted, focused, fast, certain, safe way of getting to a balanced budget amendment. So we've got Freedom Fest coming up in just a week. I hope that
actually,
a lot of folks are going to get out to Freedom Fest.
That's this Friday, July 10th, right?
It's Friday. That's right, Friday, July 10th, 1:30 p.m. That's the debate, and Saturday, July 11th at 4 p.m., Planet Hollywood, Las Vegas. One of the reasons to go to Freedom Fest is the train crash. There might be an interesting opportunity to observe Donald Trump give a speech on Saturday. That doesn't mean I support Donald Trump. I have no preference for him, but one can say that he's certainly an entertaining person to observe.
And he's got everybody talking.
He does. He absolutely does. And there's also going to be a number of other folks who are running for president there. I think Marco Rubio is going to be there. There's going to be guys like Dinesh D'Souza talking about their political prisonerhood for violating campaign finance laws. You're going to have Grover Norquist there. You're going to have Steve Moore from the Wall Street Journal, now with Heritage there. He's going to debate Paul Krugman, who deserves a good spanking. So it's going to be a really great event. And we're glad to be a part of it.
Well, I want to thank you for coming on with us to give us an update today, Nick. And if anyone that wants to go to Freedom Fest, go to freedomfest.com. That starts this Friday. And remember, contact our legislator to know that they need to get on the ball and get this compact passed here in North Carolina. So thanks again, Nick, and you're welcome back anytime.
Thank you for having me, Leah. It's a great pleasure and an honor.
All right. Take care, Nick. Well, I want to thank Nick for being on the show again, and it's been a great show to educate us on our constitutional rights and how we take back some of the power the federal government has taken from us. And next week, we are going to be talking customer service with Robert Quartz. And until next week, we would like you to stay focused on the important things. Their website is focusresourcesinc.com. WCOM-FM and Focus on Business are proud to support Make-A-Wish of Eastern North Carolina, serving the Triangle. Make-A-Wish of Eastern North Carolina is your community Make-A-Wish. To learn more about what Make-A-Wish is doing, visit their website at www.eastnc.wish.org. That's www.eastnc.wish.org. Or